impulse, as it were, that is inherent in the very fabric of the universe, within the absoluteness, as it were. She equates it with eros. And so it is, again, that principle of love, that principle of caring, of really genuine caring. Now, yesterday, we were midway on page 64, and kind of concerning the cycle, which, of course, then is through every star, through every the planets, that is to say, the globes. And I commented on the fact that while we see these generally in that traditional way and this being globe D or our Earth, and therefore the planetary chain, these on the ascending, being slightly higher than on the descending, and we traditionally see it that way, and therefore we traditionally see the levels of human consciousness in the planes. We speak of that. There is another way that these can be looked at. Incidentally, the globe G was originally called globe Z, or for my friends from down under, globe Z, but actually Z, but from the American language, so I have to use both, Z and Z. Try to remember that. I got very used to saying Z down there. Yeah, she says, you said Z. Well, I still say, half the time here, I say Z, and nobody knows what I'm talking about, but anyway.
That's because you might speak French.
Yes.
French.
That's right. But there is another way, and I think it's helpful, and I'd like to pause and suggest this to you. So would you like to pass this out? This is the diagram which E.L. Gardner has presented, and it is based on a statement in The Secret Doctrine, which is a statement from I had this neatly marked. Which is a statement from the Mahatmas. And I think it's extremely...
Where's the statement from,
Joy? I'll tell you in a moment. Now, just let me... Well, I had this all neatly marked. And where are we? Why do I lose the markings in this section? This is taken from E.L. Gardner's Blavatsky lecture of 1959, I think, called Whence Come the Gods? You won't find it in a book like this, because I had many of E.L. Gardner's lectures and papers bound together. But there's a Blavatsky lecture, which E.L. Gardner, one of our really great students of The Secret Doctrine, delivered in England in 1959, called Whence Come the Gods? And it's in a blue pamphlet. I'm not sure whether they have it in the library, but if you can ever come across it, it's a marvelous pamphlet. Yes, here it is. Volume 1, page 166. And this gives us the further, this chain of worlds, and you'll notice that K.H., in summarizing what he's trying to point out to Sennett, on page 65 there, in letter 18, if you go to page 6, just across the page from where we were reading, he speaks about that chain of worlds this is item C there, is not only an epicycloid, but an elliptical orbit of existences, having as every ellipse not one but two points, two foci, which can never approach each other, man being at one focus of it and pure spirit at the other. So this is the chain of worlds. Now, HPB, volume 1, page 166, points out that our globe, as taught from the first, is at the bottom of the arc of descent, where the matter of our perceptions exhibits itself in its grossest form. Hence, it only stands to reason that the globes which overshadow our earth must be on different and superior planes. Now, that's the way we've usually marked them. But this is a quotation from one of the Mahatma letters. In short, as globes, they are in coadjunation, but not in consubstantiality with our earth. And that's what E.L. Gardner has therefore represented here, a common center in coadjunation. That is to say, they are united. They are united through that center, as it were. But they are of different substance. This is extremely important as we come to, indeed, the after-death conditions, which depends on knowing also the whole constitution of the human being. So I thought that you might find this diagram useful to see how this can be really brought about, because they... And thus, yes, they are in coadjunation, but not in consubstantiality with our earth, and thus pertain to quite another state of consciousness. Our planet, like all those we see, is adapted to the peculiar state of its human stock, that state which enables us to see with our naked eye the sidereal bodies, which are coessential with our terrene plane and substance, and so on. So... Well, I won't. There isn't anything need to read it further. But if you then recognize that the levels of human consciousness from dense physical to Atman are also in coadjunation, even if not consubstantiality, then you have a perfect picture in this respect, which is very interesting. I didn't do this, but he has also a symbolic representation of the chain and showing the symbolism of, I'll leave this up here, showing the symbolism of the Theosophical Seal also, which he points to and develops this in a very interesting... he also is quoting the Master's letters quoted in the Secret Doctrine concerning the interrelationship of the seven globes of our chain, which is similar to the seven principles of the human being, the human constitution, because there is always an exact correspondence.
Could you say in simple English that all the different planes and all the different globes are centered around the same point?
That's right.
But they're on different levels of the planes.
Well, they're different substance. They're different vibrations, but they are all present here. They're immediately present here. This is the point. Now, this gets perhaps a little bit complicated when we go on further to point out that for every sphere that is causative, there is a sphere of effects. And this also is what makes communication with the deceased, from his point of view, really not possible. So we have to add that there are shadows, as it were, of these, which are the spheres of effects. But they're all here. I think, again, as HPB indeed on page 167 points out, referring to these early letters. And much more of this is given in letter number 67, which we're not taking up. First of all, it's given in letter 44 and letter 67, if you want to follow through on some of these aspects. And as H.P.B. points out, in these early letters, in which the terms had to be invented and words coined, the rings were often, very often became rounds, and the rounds life cycles, and vice versa. To a correspondent who called a round a world ring, the teacher wrote, "I believe it will lead to further confusion." A round we are agreed to call the passage of a monad from globe A to globe Z or G. The world ring is correct. Moria advised Mr. Sinnott strongly to agree upon a nomenclature before going any further. And so this is part of our problem always. But it's not so much different planes as different vibratory rates, different substances, therefore, which are all interlinked. And my analogy is to fill a glass with sand and then fill it with water. And they're all present. The water and the sand is simultaneously present in the glass. But they are of different substances, even chemically.
But how is that different?
Well, I think planes gives us this sort of layer cake sort of thing.
Yeah, but it's what we've come to, the terminology.
I know it, and I think we've got to change our views, is my feeling, that we've become, because today, if we're going to also adopt an approach that's going to help us with contemporary science and contemporary thought, I think we simply have to expand. Just as we laid aside Chaucerian English and Shakespearean English and we speak another kind of English today, I think we have to speak a new language.
What you're working on, it seems to me, which I totally agree with, is avoiding the layer cake.
That's right. Yes.
And getting a much more integrated situation.
A much more integrated, which is what it is. And the word plane I would abolish. And when I write, I don't use it because I think it is misleading.
But they point out in letter 18 that there are, I'm not quite sure of the expression, but there are clear boundaries, nevertheless, of substance.
That's right. Yes. So it seems to me we need a new language. And I think we have to look at this from the point of view of consciousness and our comprehension of it. Now, if you're happy with plain, but I think then we often give a wrong impression to people.
Just to tie this in with the nomenclature we usually use, field would be better.
Field is much better. Field is very much better. And that's why Fritz came to use only that word. He abolished long ago the word plain.
Whatever we use, I think it should emphasize the dynamic.
That's right.
Vitality that's ever moving.
Yes, that's right.
It's a very dynamic model.
It's a
layer cake is not a dynamic.
And the word plane to me is not dynamic, and I think it doesn't convey the totality of what we're after. Anyway, that's use the terms you want, as Moria advised Sinnott. You use your terms, and so on, Jim.
In fact, even in terms of these metaphors, there's an explosion going on right now with what's called string theory.
Yes.
Where we've taken dimensions out into 12 or 11, depending.
That's right.
And four of the dimensions aren't even spatial.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And so, I mean, they're in the same, quote, place, unquote, mm-hmm. but they're not spatial.
They're not spatial.
And so the metaphor that we're working on here has got to include, mm-hmm. and it is in science now, an arupa aspect.
That's right.
Of itself. I mean, it's just interesting mm-hmm. to me, this dialogue between mm-hmm. science and theosophy.
Yes. And this is what, to me, is also the exciting thing, is seeing that in the Mahatma letters, the masters were really groping to explain something which today is much easier to explain in terms of much that is happening in contemporary science. But they didn't have that, and they had to do it in the 19th century materialistic science. So. You want something? Anyway, on all of this, I certainly would recommend that you, if you want to pursue it, read this whole section in The Secret Doctrine. This is the section that HPB begins on page 152 of volume 1, A Few Early Theosophical Misconceptions Concerning Planets, Rounds, and Man. And it's inserted, you know, as it were, after stanza, shloka, the fourth shloka of stanza 6, she inserts this long passage, exposition really, which goes on for quite some time before she returns to the whole discussion of the stanzas. And so it's a very interesting one, and it's one in which she indicates that 11 stanzas were omitted, which points to a very significant fact, because she doesn't then take up the stanzas numbering them as though 11 were omitted, because she keeps to 7, which are the 7 stages of the cosmogonic process. And has to be 7, therefore. But if you want to pursue it, that I suggest you read it. And it's interesting that HPB, of course, quotes the Mahatma letters, you see, here. So she has seen what has been sent to Sennett, and then she elaborates further on this. So, as she says, that our Earth, now she... is one of a group of 7 planets, or man-bearing worlds. These 7 planets are the sacred planets of antiquity and are all septenary. So there's 7s within 7s. Now, we go on then from that point that this is the life cycle. As here we are on page 64, and pointing out that therefore, it's interesting, the Mahatma says, Mrs. Kingsford's idea is correct. The human ego is being reincarnated in several successive human bodies. And he says that's true, that's correct. And then goes on, as to its being reborn in animal forms after human incarnations, which is what HPB earlier had somewhat implied, you see, is the result of her loose way of expressing things and ideas. Another woman all over again. A little dig at HPB. But in this, what HPB was pointing to is also a profound truth, and which Plato speaks of, and which Plotinus, the great Neoplatonist, explains. When Plotinus writes, I don't have the quote before me, but in effect, Plotinus said, when Plato speaks of men becoming vultures or wolves or so on, and eagles and all the rest of it, he did not mean that the soul entered into those forms, but that the aggregate, and what we would call then, or what's called later, and in Buddhist terminology, the skandhas, take on the characteristics of these animal forms. And so, because all of those animal forms, as it were, all of those animal characteristics are what has really composed the physical body, and which is what then has to be changed or transformed even at the physical level, but done via consciousness, through consciousness, but a mutation taking place of the physical, very physical matter. And if you want to pursue that from another point of view, read this, the book by Arya Sanat, The Inner Life of Krishnamurti, the whole chapter on mutation. in which the physical brain is being transformed. And this also you find in the Aurobindian philosophy. This is what Sri Aurobindo was speaking about. And indeed, it's present in the secret doctrine. And that's why I think the whole emphasis on these letters and in the secret doctrine is on this process of mutation or transformation. And it has to affect every atom, as it were, every fiber of the physical body, and it does so through the brain, which is a completely changed. And I must say, I really think Ariel Sanat, or Miguel Sanabria, as his name really is, has done a marvelous service in pointing to this whole process of Krishnamurti in this mutation process. It's wonderful. So it's the, again and again, it's that. So not reborn in animal form after human incarnation, but animal characteristics which may cling to or be part of the skandhic composition. Can I use that adjectival form of skanda? Really, so that there is a kind of, you know, we even use in our language a kind of bestiality, almost. You know, that man is a wolf, and that woman is...
Lawyers are sharks,
and that woman is catty, you sound like a parrot repeating yourself, and you know, all of this. We even in our language, it reflects, because language reflects consciousness. Never forget that. Language reflects consciousness. And as consciousness changes, language changes. Which is why artificial languages have never gotten off the ground, because they are not the products of consciousness. And so language evolves. And I think we have to look at it from that point of view. So what we have to do then is to discriminate between the animal and spiritual egos, the jivatma, or linga sharira, and the kama-rupa, or atma-rupa, two as different things as body and mind. And mind and thought are. Which is an interesting statement, that even mind and thought are different. And this is something we have to look at also very carefully. So the Mahatma then says, that is what happens. After circling, so to say, along the arc of the cycle, circling along and within it, and I think that's where this little diagram of Gardner is rather helpful, because it's all within the whole, the kind of ring pass knot of the boundary that is established, if one wants to put it that way. The daily and yearly rotation of the earth is as good an illustration as any. Again, an analogy with the cycling through the planetary chain, the rounds that are undertaken, we therefore being in the fourth round on globe D, the present time. And having lost at every station, this is in the descending cycle, having lost at every station some of the ethereal, which means simply some of the more refined substance, the less dense substance, and acquired an increase of the denser nature or material, both spirit and matter have become pretty much equilibrized in him, which is where generally we are, pretty much equilibrized. But then he has the earth cycle to perform. And as in the process of involution and evolution downward, and it's interesting, it's not just involution downwards, but in the very process of the circling, there is always the correspondence. Now, I think generally we've thought of the involutionary cycle and then the evolutionary. But this is This is spiral at every point, if you want to put it that way. So that at every station, as he puts it, at every movement outwards or downwards, however you want to put it, there is both the descent and the ascent constantly going on. It's almost like saying you take two steps forward and one step backwards, and finally you get one step back and two steps forward. And, you know, it's that kind of a process that is taking place. And so it's going on almost simultaneously, because as there is the involution into greater density, there is also an evolution of spirit in terms of consciousness, dealing with that. So it's a process that is not just unidirectional. This is something that I think we forget about, because the denser it is, the more consciousness has to really work at it, doesn't it? To make it operate. So there has to be this corresponding evolution process. So
that sort of holds the key to why the whole process happens. Because that holds the key in a way.
Yes,
why
it does.
The whole process happens.
Yes.
Because all of this richness from the one life, from the consciousness side, is being turned outward.
Yes.
And made more and more physical, more and more expressed.
That's right.
It's like self-actualization.
It's a kind of self-actualization at every level.
Right.
Yes.
So that you start in unity and you end in unity, but unity A is not the same as unity B.
Right.
No, that's
because
right.
Because by then you've had the self-consciousness, you're aware of
that's
unity.
Right.
It's a whole different...
It's a whole different ballgame at that stage, yes. And you're, therefore, a fully transformed person.
Right.
Yes. This is...
Darrell Rennie says that what began as a melody at the end finished as a whole symphony.
Yes, I like that statement of Darrell Rennie's. Is that in the
Music
of the Mind? Yes, beautiful book, Music of the Mind.
Ken Wilber calls it the pre-trans fallacy.
Yes.
It's a sense of unity like oceanic babyhood. And then you go through the individualization. And then you come to a unity, but in a whole different state where you're aware of the unity and you have understood the individuality.
That's right. Yes. Which reminds me, too, Fleming showed me a book this morning, which is also a very excellent one. It's a Studies in the Secret Doctrine by Josephine Ransom, which actually is based on a series of talks that Josephine Ransom, who was an English woman and she was an international lecturer. She was briefly vice president of the society. And I say briefly only because she met with a tragic accident in streets of London and died as a result. She gave a series of talks on the secret doctrine at the summer school of the society in this country, at our headquarters in Wheaton, Illinois, in 1938 I can't remember just the year. Anyway, and it's published as Studies in the Secret Doctrine and has an excellent chapter on the Dhyan Chohans and Dhyani Buddhas. And there it relates the... do you have the book there, Fleming? Because it's a very helpful chapter if you want to read it. The book is long since out of print. One of these things, which might be, yes, but relates these emanations of the Dhyani Buddhas to the triple vestures of the Trikaya of Buddhism, and the Dharmakaya, which is of course the vesture of the Dharma, of truth, of wisdom, which is the all embracing. The Dhyani Buddhas then to the Sambhogyakaya's vesture, which is the universal. And so these are the stages in that sense of this whole evolutionary process, which is why the unity at the end, wearing the Dharmakaya vesture, is different than the oceanic unity at the beginning. That's what Shirley said reminded me of this. And of course the Manushya Buddhas the human Buddhas become the lower rung of the triple universal self, the Nirmanakayas, the Bodhisattvas, who then exist but to serve humanity. And so she has an excellent survey of this in a chapter on Dhyana Buddhas and Dhyan Chohans. Thank you, Fleming, very much bringing that to our attention. So, unfortunately, as I say, the book is out of print, but it's an excellent study.
Is that from the library here, Joe?
Did you get that?
From the library here, yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Good. Mm-hmm.
Studies in the Secret Doctrine by Josephine Ransom.
The other thing that I didn't realize for a long time is that each Mahavantara isn't the same either.
No.
I mean, it's not just an endless repetition.
That's right.
It's more and more nuanced.
It's more and
each
more.
Each time through.
That's
so
right.
It's a process that becomes more and more conscious.
That's empathy. Right. All the time, more and more conscious, yes. And nor is each planetary chain just a repetition of the past, because they're always the seeds that are left over.
Right.
Any more than your new incarnation is completely new. It'd be wonderful. And the fact, in one of the letters, I've forgotten which letter. Do you remember, Jim?
No.
Which letter? There's a marvelous statement that it would be wonderful if we had sort of karmic sweepers to come along behind us and sweep away all the debris from each incarnation. And so, you know, but we don't. It would be wonderful to feel that everything that we've, all of our failures and mistakes, were swept up into a dustpan and dumped out by these karmic sweepers, and we could start afresh.
Pick up after ourselves, huh?
We have to pick up after ourselves. This is the problem. both in keeping house and in getting new incarnations. We have to constantly pick up. So then, when arrived at the lowest point of his pilgrimage, the once pure planetary spirit, that's following an individual, as it were, will be found dwindled to what science agrees to call a primitive or primordial man. So the once pure, this is the movement down, which has been also not a steady movement, because there has been a spiral along the way, so that at times you seem to be going up. And I'm glad Shirley reminded me of that statement of Wilbur, the pre-trance.
You get the two mixed up, so it's
yes.
called a fallacy.
It's a fallacy, because you think, I'm on the way up. And I don't know if you have the experience that I often had. I become very suspicious when things are going along too well. Because too often I have found that I'm really, now I've got it made. Everything's going fine, and I fall flat on my face. Or something comes along to knock me in the head and say, hey, you know, you haven't really learned that lesson, and you better go back and start again. And it's that sort of thing, because you get into this fallacy that, by golly, it all's going well. And then suddenly you're knocked down. I knew you were coming for something.
Something specific, you're right.
That's all right, Corey. I thought Corey's coming. Catching up on you, Jim. Yeah, she's finding out if you really came to class today. Okay, so, but notice now another teaching that is given more emphasis later, that the primordial or primitive person is amid a nature as primordial, speaking geologically. For physical nature keeps pace with the physiological. So here again, I think is a kind of hint, if I can put it this way, that the very terrain, the very geological formation of the planet is at the same stage as the density of the physical at any particular cycle. So that the environment, in that sense, we are indeed co-creators of our world, thinking of the world as the physical environment in which we're established. That it really, it proceeds correspondentially. So we better take better care of the world. Just as we have to take care of the physical body, we have to take care of the environment in which the physical body is established, is stationed. But this is also very definitely given emphasis in, it's given very great emphasis in volume 2 of The Secret Doctrine, dealing with anthropogenesis, you see, that the planet itself reflected the stage at which the human being was in the development.
From the beginning.
From the beginning.
Clear about it.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't he actually say somewhere that nature follows man, not the other way?
That's right. Yes. Mm-hmm. So nature follows the developmental stages of the human being.
And it speaks of the planet as geologically following pari passu.
Yes, pari passu.
Step by step.
Step by step.
Along with humanity. Mm-hmm.
That's right. You see how much he packed into this.
Yeah.
It's incredible, in one paragraph, everything that gets stretched out in The Secret Doctrine and in later letters is clarified and so on. But if you read it, just read it through, you can miss these little statements that have a great deal of meaning. So at that point, but it's interesting, it's at that point, this is the lowest level, this is the ground state, as it were. Can we call it that? At that point, the great law begins its work of selection, because now there has to come a turning point. But be careful. There are still lower worlds, and that's pointed out in the next sentence. So, but it's at this stage where there is this real clash, can we put it this way, this real clash between dense matter and consciousness. How else is self-consciousness awakened, in one sense? Well, how else is by the descent of a previous hierarchy, a hierarchy that preceded ours, that stimulated it. But that leads into a whole nother subject, which ultimately has to be dealt with somehow, the descent of the Manasaputras, the awakeners of the mind, to really stimulate by, in some cases, incarnating within the nascent humanity as it's beginning its struggle, by some cases just lighting a dim flame, so to speak, and in some cases leaving it vacant, which led to some problems later.
When we talk about the pure spirit or energy that makes this pilgrimage through the descent back to the perfected form, are we speaking of that entity that makes that pilgrimage? Are we speaking of the monad?
Yes, and we'll come to that in a moment, too. Because, well, we'll come to that in just a moment. Well, we can come to it now, actually, because when we come on to the point that from thence, that matter found entirely divorced from spirit is thrown over into the still lower worlds, into the sixth gati, which is the Buddhist term, way of rebirth, of the vegetable and mineral worlds and of the primitive animal forms. Now, here is where a very interesting selection seems to be made. And this is a difficult kind of thing to to really get a hold of. But the Mahatma says, matter is ground over in the workshop of nature and proceeds soulless, that is to say, proceeds without any spark of, this is the top of page 65, proceeds soulless without any spark of manas at all awakened, back to its mother fount. It's nothing is wasted. Within the whole system, nothing is wasted. But it's ground over again, as it were. While the egos purified of their dross, those who really make it, are enabled to resume their progress once more onward. Here, there are certain critical stages all along the way. And this seems to be one of the truly critical ones, because it is here then that the laggard egos perish by the millions, the solemn moment of the survival of the fittest, the annihilation of those unfit. Now, at this stage, when it says the laggard egos, these are not self-conscious units. Consciousness, indeed, has not awakened at all. So be very careful on this term, the laggard egos. But what has been followed, this comes to your question, Jim, what has been followed is, as it were, the descent of a monad through all of this. But we have to be careful, a great warning, I think, that we think we're following an individual unit through the process. Now, HPB clarifies this in volume 1, page 178. It's also in this section. And she says, she lists the monad, 174, she lists the monadic host, and this is the three classes of the monads, and it helps us to see this. First, the most developed, whose function it is to pass in the first round through the whole triple cycle of the mineral, vegetable, and animal kingdoms in their most ethereal, filmy, and rudimentary forms in order to clothe themselves in and assimilate the nature of the newly formed chain. Then the second, those monads that are the first to reach the human stage and become man. Now, hopefully we're in that group. I mean, well, I guess we've reached the human stage, so most of us are maybe not, you know, we're on our way. You know, there's a marvelous, I think, in Islam, you know, that God baked the clay for 40 years, and then it began to move, and then he gave it another 40 years, and some never did get fully baked, and which is why I say probably many of us are half-baked, but anyway, this is part of the mythology of Islam. But the third is the laggards, which are retarded, and which will not reach by reason of karmic impediments the human stage at all during this cycle or round. So we have this also clarified by HPB, and you can read the whole section, but she points out on page 178, it would be very misleading, and this is from an article that she wrote and that she actually wrote in 1883, but it was also based on the Mahatmic teachings, which she knew and which also are presented here. She said, it would be very misleading to imagine a monad as a separate entity trailing its slow way in a distinct path through the lower kingdoms, and after an incalculable series of transformations, flowering into a human being. In short, that the monad of a Humboldt, who was a scientist, you know, dates back to the monad of an atom of hornblende. Instead of saying a mineral atom, the corrector phraseology, we would say more correct, I think, but she says the corrector phraseology in physical science, which differentiates every atom, would, of course, have been to call it the monad manifesting in that form of Prakriti, or original matter, called the mineral kingdom. The tendency towards segregation into individual monads is gradual, and in the higher animals comes almost to the point. So then she talks about the monadic essence and so on. So the state of the monadic consciousness through all the kingdoms up to man. But now it is an individual, yes. But at this stage is not. So when we talk about the laggard egos perishing by the millions, they have. This is that also by karmic impediments, which is not explained, but also that no spark of the...